This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, the best bits from Sunday, November the 22nd. Coming up, we hear from Bruno Trenchard from CBRE. The global pandemic has highlighted the need to stimulate UAE's domestic tourism. Domestic tourism? Staycation? Call it what you will. No denying there's been a higher demand for staycations in recent months. So is that a trend that will continue once flights and international travel reopens? Plus, we'll be listening back to our chat about all things George W. Bush. Do you remember when they closed the road, Sheikh Zayed Road, for the arrival and the departure of George W. Bush back in, what was it, 2008, 2009, around about those times? Your thoughts came flooding through with regards to that, a lot of memories being jogged from that conversation. We also spoke to Feroz Tarapore from DAE a little earlier on. They reported a 38% drop in profits for the first half of the year compared to the first 6 months of 2019. We wanted to know from Feroz why. I mean, fairly straightforward, given what they, of course, do on a day-to-day basis and what's been going on. But let's hear from Feroz a little later on in proceedings. And before all that, of course, we got our regular update from Serena Kelly.
Ask Serena.
With Fragoman, dedicated exclusively to immigration services worldwide.
Morning, guys.
Morning, Serena.
Yes, Tom, I have you back.
Thanks, mate. It's nice. Nice to know.
Yeah. Serena's sticking up for Tom this morning after absolutely eating him alive on Thursday.
Yeah, with the whole Sheikh Zayed Road thing being shut down and everything in both directions. But it's true. Like, you were talking about George W. Bush, his visit. And yes, Sheikh Zayed Road was shut down in both directions for him. But this weekend, the event, Dubai Ride, that Tom was emceeing, it was shut down in both directions for the general public to be able to go on and cycle. So technically, he's not wrong, because it's never been shut down for people to use in that way on both sides of the road before, because you had Dubai Run the previous year. And it was only one side.
That's right, yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I know we could take technicalities, but no, it is. It's fact.
We're not going to argue with Serena. Too scared to argue with you. You challenged Tom to the octagon last time he argued with you. We've all learned from that. Thank you for the memories that are flooding in, by the way. Don't forget to pop the word Meshrick on them as well. Right, where are we with case numbers, Serena?
So this time last week, we were looking at figures of 1,174. And after more than 133,000 tests were conducted across the UAE yesterday, they announced 1,262 new cases of COVID-19 in the Emirates. So we have a total confirmed tally of 157,785. Breaking the figure down for you, we had one fatality reported yesterday. So we're now at 548 deaths in the country. 771 recoveries yesterday. So we're at 148,080 recoveries. And active cases currently stands at 9,157. Just looking internationally, cases globally, reported confirmed cases, more than 58.4 million, out of which more than 16.6 million are active. You've had more than 1.38 million fatalities, and those recovered, more than 40.4 million.
Right. And we've got, obviously, our vaccine trial going on at the moment. We've got the air corridor between the UAE and the UK. What's the latest?
So with currently with the phase three vaccine trials here in the UAE, the UK ambassador to the Emirates, Patrick Moody, has been discussing the third phase of the COVID-19 vaccine clinical trials. That's with the Abu Dhabi Health Services company, Seha. So the British ambassador, he was given a tour of Seha's specialised centre, the Abu Dhabi Exhibition Centre, where they've been taking the volunteers for the trials. Also received a briefing on the process, demonstrating its safety and effectiveness. So it's interesting that he's paid a visit and they've been in talks. Obviously, you know, we know that it was given the emergency approval recently. It's been provided to frontline healthcare workers. Phase one and two trials conducted in China proved very positive because the volunteers were producing antibodies. Phase three has also shown positive results. So it'd be interesting to see what comes off the back of the discussions. Also, with the UK lockdown in the country, it's been announced that it will end as scheduled on December 2nd. So they will return to a three-tier system, but with more areas facing restrictions. So they're calling it the COVID winter plan. It's expected to be published later, setting out the government's next phase in limiting COVID-19 in the country. So we should find out which areas will be placed into which tier during this week. You've also got a travel bubble between Hong Kong and Singapore. That was due to launch today, but it's been postponed for 2 weeks because that was after a jump in coronavirus cases in Hong Kong. And you know how there was a sudden 6-day lockdown implemented in South Australia recently? Would you like to know how that came about?
Is this the pizza guy?
Yes! So a man lied to authorities who were trying to conduct contact tracing. The man tested positive, told officials he'd gone to a pizza bar, bought a pizza. Turns out he'd actually worked several shifts. Now, authorities assumed that man had caught a different strain of the virus because it was such a short exposure time. So they were worried that it was quite contagious. But apparently he'd been working alongside another worker who tested positive. So had he been truthful from the start, contact tracing teams would not have... They wouldn't have actually initiated that 6-day lockdown, which is a shame.
Yeah, there you go. Tell the truth to the people asking you where you've been and what you've been doing. Serena Kelly, thank you very much for your time this morning.
More details on the ARN News Centre app.
Let's get some more details on something that's going on at the moment. In fact, Serena, before you leave, tell me the dates of the G20, please.
Today is the last day. So it started yesterday and finishes today.
It's like having your own personal Alexa, really. Ed Bell is the Senior Director for Market Economics at Emirates NBD. And we've been asking him about what's happening with the G20 as well. As you would understand, there has been a lot of focus on the coronavirus and what's happening with vaccines.
Saudi Arabia has been hosting this year's G20's Leaders Summit, where the inevitable focus has been on how to coordinate public health responses to the COVID-19 pandemic, along with coming up with a plan to offset the economic damage caused by the pandemic, particularly among emerging economies. So far, there's only been an initial draft pledging members of the G20 to ensure affordable and equitable access to any vaccines and public health responses for coronavirus. While markets have got a boost in the past few weeks, thanks to the successful test of two vaccine candidates, the one from Pfizer and one from Moderna, the logistical challenges in distributing those vaccines could put a lot of countries with less developed public health infrastructures at risk. Now, this has always been a risk of the response to coronavirus, developing inequality between those who could afford a vaccine and those who can't, those who are in a position to, say, work from home and those who cannot. So the G20 this year is really trying to offset the pending boost in that kind of inequality.
Of course, one of the big questions around the G20 wasn't so much about what they were going to discuss. It was about who was going to be there. Even though it was virtual, you didn't even need to leave your house. The big question was whether or not there was going to be an appearance by a certain American president.
U.S. President Trump also attended the meeting briefly, but wouldn't commit to sharing the U.S.-made vaccines with the rest of the world. And that's raising the risk of another concern of so-called vaccine nationalism. So countries that could and afford the vaccine, richer countries, may be at the front of the line to receive them, putting more of the developed world at risk of not being able to get their economies back on track for some time.
But coronavirus, of course, is not the only thing that is, or at least should be, catching our attention at the moment. We said to Ed, what else was discussed at the G20?
A second but related goal for the G20 this year has been how to bolster the funds of the IMF, so it's better able to help economies that are struggling in response to COVID-19. Increasing the reserves of the fund would require approval from the United States, which has the largest share of votes in the IMF, and they have already rejected a plan earlier this year to increase the fund's assets by around $500 billion. With the U.S. in a period of leadership transition, we're not really expecting much headway on the ability of the G20 to increase the IMF's firepower, while other countries are going to try and step into a global leadership role, like China or the EU, for instance, to help shepherd the global economy out of the COVID-19 recession. Already, we've seen some defaults among African countries in response to the coronavirus pandemic. So getting some form of relief up and going quite quickly will be quite crucial to ensure that there's not lingering economic scars as a result of COVID-19.
That is Ed Bell from Emirates NBD.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Well, let's look at a business now that does use a fair bit of fuel. Also, a business that will be happy about the vaccine news, and that is aviation. A plane leasing company, Dubai Aerospace Enterprise, reporting a 38% drop in profits for the first half of this year. They have come out with their first 9-month numbers, but with ambitious plans to expand their fleet. We we are joined now by Feroz Terapore, who is the CEO of DAE, Dubai Aerospace Enterprise. Feroz, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us.
Good morning.
Do you want to just give us the highlights from your first 9 months of this year?
Sure. There is no disputing that we are a COVID-impacted business. But within that, I think we've delivered what I would characterize as kind of home run numbers, where we've been able to use our financial strength to not only benefit our clients, but also to underwrite some pretty good business that would serve as the foundation of the future growth of our company. The numbers are kind of what they are. They're, of course, down from what they were in 19, but that's to be expected when our clients, who are the commercial airlines, are impacted in such a significant way. But when we look at what we've done, we're super happy with where we are on the numbers and on how well we've positioned our company for future growth.
Where have you seen that biggest impact for us? What has that looked like for you?
Right. For us, I think the biggest thing is that our clients need relief in an unprecedented way because their revenue has been taken away in an unprecedented way. So we have spent a good deal of the last 9 months sitting across from our clients and understanding how their business is impacted and putting together the right kind of assistance package for them. So it could be a rent deferral as simple as, okay, we can see you cannot pay us in the month of May, June, and July, but when times get better, we expect payment back. Or it could be something more complicated where we say, yes, we can see you can't pay us now, but what if there were certain other things you can give us in the future? And I think that clients have really appreciated the fact that they could come to us despite a legally binding agreement and have an open discussion and find in us a receptive partner who will help them with their business today to ensure for our mutual benefit that they're around tomorrow.
Has the discussions then been more about paying for the planes, when you pay for the planes, how you pay for the planes, rather than whether or not the airlines need the planes?
No. I think that for us, liquidity is not an issue. We do not have speculative commitments. So scrambling to pay for planes when there are no clients is not an issue for us. So for us, it's really a matter of ensuring that if our client has a monthly obligation to pay us, that's the lease rental, and they are unable to do so, that we are in a position to understand why and devise the appropriate relief as needed. In many cases, we've said no because we didn't the case didn't ring correct. But in many cases, we have said yes.
Oh, let me put that a little bit of a different way then. Is there still as much actual demand for the aircraft regardless of payment?
There actually is because the fundamental trend in aviation that we have seen for the last 40 years, which is that air traffic demand doubles every 15 years, despite events in the past like 9/11, like SARS, like global financial crisis, they all had immediate impact that were quite large. Now, of course, this impact is larger than any of the prior impacts, but it is also undisputed that when we come out of it, the trend towards that longer-term growth driven by population, disposable income, et cetera, is very much intact. So operators are basically saying, look, if we let go of the planes now, we will not have the right kit to nurture our business model. So they are doing everything they can to retain the aircraft, to quickly put them back into service as soon as we have resolution on both the convenience and the safety dimensions which are holding back air traffic demand at the moment.
Do you think you'll see a shift in who your clients are? I mean, we know that the pandemic is hitting, it's hitting all airlines. You can't move out of the way of it, but certainly the futures of some have seemed more questionable than others.
Since the onset of the pandemic, there are about 30 airlines who are no longer around in their prior form. So some have exited completely, some have restructured, et cetera. And we expect maybe a few more to go the same way if conditions persist for longer than what people expect. But if that doesn't happen, we think that ultimately airlines will survive. And from our standpoint, so this is from a leasing company standpoint, we are focusing in this interim period on the really top-notch credits who need things and are willing to give things in exchange for us providing them solutions and getting that business. So the credit quality of our portfolio is going up as a result of that as well. This is a good development from our perspective.
How much of an impact will a successful vaccine have on your business?
So I think there are two or three things. A successful vaccine is obviously a critical step. And you saw that in the reaction of stock prices when the Pfizer thing came out a couple of weeks ago, and then the Moderna thing came out a little bit recently. And so it is clearly a big driver. But what is also then important is all the other stuff around convenience, harmonization, actual treatment, et cetera, et cetera. But this for us will restore hope in a way that will provide an incredible tailwind to air traffic demand coming back. And then we build on that by doing all these other things.
Well, I mean, there certainly seems to be a bit of hope in your organization anyway. You've got some big plans to expand the fleet.
Yeah, so we announced in November that we had signed up customers for an additional $1.1 billion of aircraft that will be delivered as we speak. So in the next 4 or 5 months, that will all be delivered. And then our goal is to add another $1 billion between now and the end of 2021, which would take our fleet size to somewhere around 450 aircraft. Looking at it the way we do, which is the combination of owned aircraft, managed aircraft, and aircraft that we have committed to own. So we are excited only because we see a phenomenal opportunity to increase our size within very, very long-term attractive kind of characteristics of the business that we're in. So this is a unique and a good thing from our perspective. Meaning the opportunity to augment our market position.
Do you already have customers lined up for those planes?
Yes, we don't acquire any planes unless there is a customer that comes along with that. That is known as a sale leaseback in our business. So we don't have speculative order positions, and in the very near future, it doesn't appear that that's going to change.
30 seconds for us. Is this a good time to be buying a plane, like a car at the moment? Have you got a good negotiating position?
Look, from our standpoint, not only is it a good time to be acquiring an aircraft, but it is also a good time to be placing it with really solid long-term credit lessees who will use that plane well and who will help us kind of get to the right returns on that aircraft.
Feroz Terapore, CEO of Dubai Aerospace Enterprise, DAE, talking through the first 9 months' results with us, as well as their plans to expand their fleet.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
You have opened a can of worms here, Tom Urquhart.
Go on.
Not only were you foolish enough to take on Serena Kelly last week by saying about one lane or two lanes when it came to opening up the Shakeside Road, closing down the Shakeside Road for the cycling, and Serena put you very firmly in your place.
Yep.
You've now taken on the listenership of the Business Breakfast when it comes to George W. Bush Day, as it will forever be known, in 2007.
Ah, you're right, Adam. Thank you very much indeed. Adam has been in touch with us.
Masood.
Thank you to Masood as well. We had both, Adam saying both sides of Shakeside Road were closed in 2007 when George W. Bush came to Dubai. We were living on Shakeside Road at the time. So, Adam, thank you for that. Masood says, Ross is right, Tom. Shakeside Road was closed in both directions for George W. Bush's visit. I think it was around January the 8th. Oh, hang on. 2007, 2008. Can anyone remember when it was?
Can I tell you one of my favourite Malcolm Taylor stories?
Yes.
To do with George W. Bush Day. This was when the US president, was he president at the time? Yes, he was.
He was, yeah.
Yep. Came to the UAE, and yes, they did shut for security reasons and everything else a lot of the roads, possibly both directions on the Sheikh Zayed. One of my favourite stories or memories about the late, great Malcolm Taylor, fitting given that we're talking about sharing your Dubai memories this morning. I spent 12 plus years working with Malcolm Taylor, a good percentage of my memories do involve Malcolm Taylor. So we had George W. Bush Day, and the bosses said to us, look, you don't need to do the, you know, basically, we'll give you the day off the show. We'll pre-record a special edition of the show because we don't want you getting stuck. We don't want you getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, coming to work, but then not being able to get home from work because obviously you need to get home, nap, all the rest of it, prep for the next day's show.
Was everyone given the day off?
I think just us.
Okay.
I think a lot of people, no, I'd say that. I think a lot of businesses did give their people the day off because they didn't want people stuck in the roads.
Was it a public holiday that day or something, or not?
Oh, now see, you're testing my memory here. But I know that we were told, look, what we'll do is we'll record a special edition of the show. Don't come in because you're just going to get stuck. And Malcolm said, no, I will come in. I have figured it out. I have looked at maps. I have consulted the interweb. I have gone on to special forums where various women who are married to people who have interesting jobs and therefore might know things discuss what they know. And I have a route, said Malcolm Taylor. I have a route home to Jumeirah One. Worry about me not. I will come in. He went, and I say this with absolute love, a bit Boy Scout cross Navy commando SEAL about it. He was not going to be beaten by a citywide lockdown for anybody's president. Malcolm was going to get through and he was going to get home. So he said, no, I'm coming in, I'm doing the show. I've got it sorted. I have figured out which back roads will be open and I have plotted myself a course. I said, all right, good-o. Turned the alarm off, slept in, obviously, took advantage of the situation. About 6 hours later, I got a phone call from Malcolm, who was stuck on the roads and couldn't go anywhere and stayed that way for some considerable time.
Just wasn't moving.
No, it just wasn't moving. Wasn't going anywhere. His route was not entirely foolproof. He did not get his green beret or whatever it was. And he was so excited about beating the system as well, bless him.
But he didn't. The system won that day. It was a holiday, yeah. I just found the press release from the day. So the Emirate declared a public holiday for employees in the government, private and the educational sectors. Authorities closed most of the city's main roads where the motorcade would pass. As a result, the whole city was paralysed, forcing many residents to walk. Security issues.
Dubai residents in walking shocker.
Just a shame you didn't have the steppy app then. That would have been a good day to have it, isn't it? People reporting
some of them had to carry their own shopping. It was a travesty. Society broke down.
Passengers travelling at the Dubai International Airport were told to report 6 hours before their flights to ensure that they got onto their flights. Because only one route to the airport was open as a result.
Well, Serena Kelly's putting you in your place again, and she's not even in the room. So she's obviously listening to us, knows that we have been saying, well, it's been closed down both lanes before. This is Serena telling you why this weekend's road closure, thank you very much, is different.
When listeners are saying Sheikh Zayed Road was shut down in both directions for George W. Bush, but yes, the weekend, it was the first time that people were allowed on, like the general public, on Sheikh Zayed Road on both sides, because George W. Bush was the only one on the road at the time. No one else was allowed on it.
Well, presumably George W. Bush's driver, but I take your point, Serena Kelly.
See, she's got my back on this one, as opposed to going, against me. She's got my back on this one, yeah. So this was the first time that that the road had been opened up to the public as well, rather than world leaders.
It's all in the wording, isn't it?
Talking of POTUS, did you see what Twitter did over the weekend? They confirmed on Friday that they're going to hand the at POTUS account to Mr. Biden on Inauguration Day. They're going to take it away from DT, Donald Trump, and hand it to Mr. Biden.
So, POTUS and FLOTUS, presumably?
I'm assuming, yeah. I didn't see about that. FLOTUS as well is also included, as is at PressSec as well.
Mm-hmm. Because they go, the titles go with the job rather than the person.
Yeah, but imagine trying to get that off of Donald there. He's not going to give that one up, is he?
Well, you just need the passwords.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Often quite reluctant to talk about pandemic wins. Pandemic's been tough on so many individuals, so many industries the world over. But is it fair to table the motion that domestic tourism has been a pandemic win during 2020. The global pandemic has certainly highlighted the need to stimulate UAE's domestic tourism, which has always been here, but have we ever relied on it as much as we have in the last 10 months? Well, to reflect on this, we're joined by the Senior Manager in Hospitality and Leisure Division at CBRE. Bruno Trenchard joins us live on the line. Morning, Bruno.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Bruno, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, all of us who spent time here in the region will be appreciative of the fact that domestic tourism, the staycation, has been part and parcel of the offering here. But is it also fair to say that the majority of people that call the UAE home always look a little further than that? And international travel is something that's intertwined with their being here in the region.
Yeah, definitely, because you have such a large population of expatriates in the region, they tend to go back home for holiday or travel to other places as well. So definitely the country has been a very strong emitter of tourists. But we believe there's a big opportunity for domestic tourism, and we probably all realized this during the last 10 months, as you just mentioned, yeah.
So what is the future of, I mean, before we get into the future, let's get onto the present at the moment. Have you been able to quantify just how much of an impact COVID-19, the coronavirus pandemic, has had on the domestic tourism industry here? I'm assuming that they've seen increase in numbers.
Yes, in some sectors of the market, especially resorts. So when we look at resorts, desert resorts or beach resorts or even mountain resorts for that matter, we've seen a very, very big increase in demand from residents and UAE nationals, and some resorts in the Northern Emirates, especially in Fujairah and Ras Al Khaimah, they've been virtually full every weekend because residents wanted an escape from Dubai or from Abu Dhabi. They wanted to go somewhere by the beach with the family. So we've seen a massive spike in demand in those Emirates. And if we look at occupancy rates for Fujairah, for Ras Al Khaimah, for instance, here today they're almost at 50%, which is a very decent performance in the midst of a worldwide pandemic, actually.
And yet, you know, you look at the majority of the campaigns launched by Dubai Tourism, Abu Dhabi Tourism, Ras Al Khaimah and others. You know, a lot of campaigns have targeted international guests, international tourists coming into the Emirates in past times. Do you think we're going to see a shift of focus as more campaigns are directed towards residents to maintain this domestic tourism?
So I wouldn't call it a shift of focus. I would say an addition to the previous focus. International demand will still be the key growth factor for the tourism sector in the UAE. But I think there's a way to stimulate demand from within the country to make sure that people can also take holidays within the UAE. And there's a lot to do here. And I think the government will be doing more and more of this. And we've seen this in Dubai, for instance, over the last few years, even before the pandemic. But the development of Hatta, for instance, as a tourism destination is a very good example. It's mostly targeted towards the resident population, obviously international tourists as well. But it's very, very popular with the residents. And it already was before the pandemic started.
Do you think that we fully appreciated what is available to us right here on our own doorstep with regards to options within the UAE, or has the pandemic opened our eyes to a certain degree?
I definitely believe the pandemic helped open our eyes. There's a lot to do in the country. There's a lot that can be developed in addition to what's available at the moment, but residents for sure learned more about the country because they have been staying here instead of traveling abroad for the last year or so. Not all residents, I mean, but most of them have been staying in the country. So there's a lot to discover, and people have been discovering. And I think the feedback that we've seen in the market is that people have been very happily surprised about the amount and the number of activities that they can find within the country, and the width of the activities is so different from one place to another.
Bruno, is there a worry that we might all get staycation fatigue once you have done your weekend in Fujairah, you've done your weekend in Ras Al Khaimah, you've, I don't know, gone down to Sharjah, checked out the cultural options, that we might all get a little bit, okay, been there, done that?
In a sense, yes, but as you just mentioned, there's culture offering, mountain offering, beach offering, desert offering. This is already a few staycations per year that you could do. So it's already a big, big addition to what was in the market previously. And on top of this, there's a lot of new destinations that have been that are being developed or new attractions. So the zip line in Ras Al Khaimah, for instance, that's very popular with residents. Hatta, as I mentioned previously, very popular with residents, and some desert resort as well coming up. Island resorts coming up in Abu Dhabi. So there's a lot that will be added to the market, and this will help really stimulate the demand in that sense. And I think the Dubai Tourism Authority also has slightly changed the legislation for overnight stay at desert resorts or desert camps over the last few months. So this is something that wasn't present before. So again, one addition to the offering that will help stimulate demand in the long term.
Bruno, I've got 30 seconds left on this one. Just in that final 30 seconds, simple question. Once international flights open up again, once we can travel again, will this demand for domestic tourism staycations continue?
Yes, it will continue, and we hope that there will still be some resident special offers and anything like this to stimulate demand and make sure that we also stay in the country whenever we can.
Bruno Trenchard, thank you so much indeed. Bruno is the Senior Manager in Hospitality and Leisure Division at CBRE, giving us his thoughts on the demand and the stimulation of the UAE domestic tourism market.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
And we are digging now into one of our top business stories this morning, a business story that I know that if Richard Dean wasn't on leave, he would be extremely excited about, because it includes new data and new numbers. We're always happy when there's a new index that launches here in the UAE, because it gives us a little bit more insight into what's actually happening on the ground. And there is another one coming. The Dubai Land Department has just signed with the guys at JLL, property people, the services firm, to come up with a commercial property price index. And so naturally, we want to know more. Dana Selbach is head of research for this region at Jones Lang LaSalle. She got woken up very early this morning, unexpectedly, to ask if she would speak to us. So she gets 5 points already for that. Dana, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brandy. Thank you for having me.
So tell us, what will you be creating with the Dubai Land Department?
So I had Thierry Delvaux, our CEO, on the show last week when we launched our transparency report, our global real estate transparency. And we talked about how Dubai had improved three spots to the 36th position. So it's things like these indices, is what promotes transparency or supports transparency and provides the market with more data. Last year, we saw the creation of Mu'ashid, which is the residential price index. So we're collaborating with the land department. We're partnering with them to create the same thing on the commercial side, which will give investors a lot more insight into the commercial sector, the commercial side of real estate, which is a huge leap. The market has always been dominated by residential investors. When we kind of move the market towards the commercial sector, you're looking at the larger institutional investors bringing and putting money into the market.
So what numbers will you actually be crunching? What will they take from it?
So we will be looking at commercial sales transactions across the office and retail sector. Having said that, there's not many transactions that happen on that side, but we'll also be looking at the leasing side of things. We'll be looking at commercial leases, creating a rental index as well and a sales index on the back of the transactions as well.
So the rental index, will that be broken down by types of property? Will it be broken down by areas, free zones? How will you manage that?
So it will be broken down by the two main sectors, so by the office sector and by the retail sector. We'll be looking at the performance of those two sectors from a rental perspective since 2010 to date. We'll be looking at the monthly, you know, the change on change from a monthly perspective of the rental rates. And see how the market has moved from 2010 to date, basically.
Wow. Okay. You've got a bit of work to do then to go back for the last...
There's a lot of modelling.
The last decade. Where is the raw data actually coming from, Dana?
So the raw data is coming from the land department. So this is what's key to make this a success. It's, you know, the land department's willingness to share that data with a third party, with a private sector entity, obviously covered by covered through this MOU by an NDA as well. So that raw data is not what's going to go out to the public. It's the index. So it's the kind of the analysis that will come on the back of that on the back of that raw data is what's going to go out into the public. So the land department owns that data.
Presumably, the bit that is going to be of more interest to our listeners this morning, or of more use, is going to be on the leasing side, is going to be on the rental index. How will they be able to use that data?
So as I mentioned, they'll be looking at, again, monthly changes in rental rates to initially assess the performance of the market since 2010 to date, so almost a decade. And that will just give the investors a lot more clarity when it comes to the analysis, when it comes to any forecasts, when it comes to, you know, their own modeling, how they use their numbers, crunch those numbers in their systems to make better investment decisions moving forward.
Okay, finally, Dana, before we let you go, do we have any indication of when the first commercial property price index, the CPP, will be out?
We finally signed the MOU. We're going to kickstart this process this week. We've got, we'll set up a meeting with the land department. We'll go in, we'll look at the database. There's a lot of, background work to be done, cleaning up the databases, understanding the data, the modeling, etc. So I'd say it's at least a 6-month process.
Well, we look forward to having it. And thank you very much for joining us on the show this morning. Dana Salbeck is the head of research for the MENA region at JLL, talking through one of our big stories of this morning. And that is the fact that we are to get a new property index, a new set of numbers to shed some light on what's happening in the property market, this time with a focus on commercial.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.